This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 11:30 a.m., which means that you are listening to Out of the Blue, a show bringing you the news from our coasts and oceans. My name is Tessa Campisi, and I'll be poking about in the rock pools with you this morning. As always, my voice is beaming to you from the unceded lands and waters of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I extend my respect to elders past and present. Today, on my bike ride to the studio, I rode past a long stream of people weaving their way through the streets of Fitzroy as part of the Walk for Truth, which will traverse more than 800 kilometres over the next few weeks from the steps of Parliament in Victoria to Parliament House in Canberra to call for a national truth-telling process led by First Nations people. You can head down to Dyett's Falls to join the next part of the walk at 1:30 p.m. today. You can also find another part of the walk that you might be able to join in by going to their website, which is walkfortruth.com. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Today on the show, we're talking about nests. More after this.
Disasters like flood, fire, and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work, and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
DigiChew, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
Hi, it's Tessa and you're listening to Out of the Blue. You know, as I spend more and more time on this earth, I've come to believe that there comes a point in every person's life when they start to think a lot about birds. And it hits you like an Adélie penguin bursting out of the water at 30 to 40 kilometres per hour. Before, they were just feathers in the background, but suddenly you're carrying your binoculars everywhere, you interrupt people to point them out, and you miss the bus because you're trying to see what kind of bird is nesting in that tree. Nests, in their own right, are incredibly interesting and say a lot about what is going on inside those birdy little brains. But as today's guest will tell us, the diversity, complexity, beauty of bird nests is rivaled by those made by fish. Bob Wong is a professor based in the School of Biological Sciences at Monash University and has travelled the world studying the reproductive behaviour of fish. Here's Bob.
My name is Bob Wong. I'm a professor based in the School of Biological Sciences at Monash University. I'm what's known as a behavioural ecologist, which means that I'm interested in understanding animal behaviour from an ecological and evolutionary perspective. And I've been really fortunate in my 20 plus years of being a behavioural ecologist, of having worked on a whole range of different kinds of organisms, from insects to birds, frogs, lizards, and even humans. But I have a real soft spot for fish. I grew up with lots of fish tanks, had a hobby interest in aquaria, and it's really nice to be able to carve out a career basically looking into fish tanks and trying to unravel the behavioral mysteries of fish.
I know that for birders, there's often like a spark bird, like the bird that got them hooked. Do you have a spark fish, the one that kind of got you obsessed?
That's a good question. Sort of thinking back to my childhood memories now, so I was born in Singapore and I spent the first 6 years of my life living in Singapore before migrating to Australia. And my parents had a fish tank on the balcony because, of course, in Singapore, it's a tropical country and you can keep tropical fish outside. And I remember even as a pre-6-year-old, the kissing guamis, the kissing fish. So these are fish that are native to Southeast Asia, and the fish individuals sometimes lock lips and they look like they're kissing, but in fact it's an aggressive maneuver. But I do remember even as a little kid observing these kissing guamis kissing, and I'm showing inverted commas with my hands at the moment, your listeners won't be able to see that, but yeah, I remember that was one of the earlier behavioral things that really fascinated me as a kid. So, yeah, I would probably say kissing guamis. No one's ever asked me that question before, but, yeah, I would say kissing.
This aggressive kiss between the fish, that's quite funny. Yes. So lately I've been thinking a bit about bird nests, about how they're made, what they're made of, where they're built. And so through kind of doing a little bit of research, I was directed towards your work looking at fish building and fish nest building habits. And I'd never thought of fish as being nest builders. So maybe to start off, can you explain to me how a fish egg is different to a bird egg and how that might shape the kinds of nests they need to build?
Yeah, so obviously we're dealing with animals that live in an entirely different medium. Most fish spend their entire lives in water. And of course, the egg in water is a very different proposition to eggs on land. There's, I guess, some of the problems that face terrestrial animals include the potential desiccation of eggs. And of course, we're all familiar with the eggs of birds, which have got a hard shell to protect the developing embryo. Obviously, that's not an issue in the aquatic realm. But still, you know, I would say that if you look at parental care right across the animal world, whether you're looking at birds or whether you're looking at fish, parental care is actually not that common when you look at fish. You know, when you think of a fish, as you have done, it seems, you kind of think of fish maybe spawning in the open water. The female squirts out a bunch of eggs, the male comes along and squirts out sperm, the fertilization takes place externally, and then the developing embryo are left to their own devices. So parental care is actually not that common in fish. But there are certain fish species and certain groups of fish that do engage in tender care of their offspring. And we think of seahorses as perhaps one of the most extreme examples in the entire animal world, because the males in seahorses actually undergo pregnancy and have a placenta-like connection in order to protect the brood. But another way that you can protect the brood is to build a nest, right? And you lay the eggs inside the nest and then you can defend the developing brood from potential predators, and also to look after the developing brood by maybe fanning the eggs with your pectoral fins to get a more oxygenated water and to prevent or reduce the risk of disease. And if you look at fish nesting, you have the whole gamut. You have some species where the females look after the babies. You have some species where both males and females look after the babies, although some of our research on fish, freshwater fish, shows that the distribution of workload isn't equal between the sexes. And then we've got the males, of course, which is actually more common. So unlike many other species or groups of animals, when you do have parental care taking place, it's usually the males that are the caregivers, and that includes males providing sole care of offspring. But I guess returning back to the tantalizing story I alluded to about species with biparental care. So that's the fancy term given to the scenario where both the male and the female look after babies. A few years ago, I had the good fortune of going over to Nicaragua to study these fish called cichlids. And there are cichlid fishes found in Latin America, but also in Africa, and there's a couple of species found in Asia. But the ones that we were interested in live in the crater lakes of Nicaragua, and there are some species that are found nowhere else on Earth. They're found in just a single crater lake. So I got the opportunity to go to Nicaragua to study the nesting behaviours and parental care of these cichlid fishes. And one of the species we were studying, called the poor man's trophius, actually, my intention wasn't to study that species, but I noticed that they were engaged in some really interesting behaviours. And I started to notice that, oh, hang on, the males and females seem to be caring for their brood in slightly different ways. The female seems to be working a lot harder. So we started to observe the defense of the brood by male and female poor man's trophius. And we found, yes, indeed, the females were working a lot harder. They were chasing intruders for greater distances before they gave up compared to the males. And that's consistent with some work that colleagues had done many decades earlier in Panama, working on other species of cichlid that live in streams, where they found that in the species that they studied, again, it seemed that the males weren't spending as much effort looking after the brood in the nest compared to the females. And in fact, the males were more likely to also desert the females and leave her to look after the current brood while he goes off and finds another mating partner to maximize his reproductive payoffs.
It sounds like these fish need a little bit of feminism, honestly.
I do feel so. So, absolutely.
But no, you're bringing up an interesting point, which is about the fish nesting behavior and how complex it is. So I'm wondering, what can we understand about fish cognition, how they remember, how they learn, how they interpret and respond to the world through observing their nesting behavior?
Yeah, look, I think cognition plays a really important role across all facets of the nesting process, right? From locating a suitable place to build a nest. And that's becoming a huge problem in this rapidly changing world. So there's a concept called an ecological or evolutionary trap. This idea that animals might have evolved behaviors that were once adaptive, but in a rapidly changing world, they're no longer adaptive. A good example actually comes from insects that have started to lay their eggs on shiny surfaces like gravestones or even windows or cars because the shiny surface resemble the shiny surface of the water bodies that these aquatic insects would normally lay their eggs. So that's an insect example. But there could also be these kinds of things taking place when it comes to selecting suitable nesting habitats. You know, where do you go to nest, which could have implications for down the track. If you build a nest in a really crappy location, maybe it gets washed away because of strong currents. Right through to the actual nest construction itself, there's good evidence actually out there to show that when some female fish, when they're choosing potential mates, they are not only looking at the male in terms of his courtship displays or trying to gauge the quality of the male as a parent directly from observing the male. There's also evidence to show that the female will actually pay attention to the quality of the nest that he builds. Because the nest construction could actually play a really important function as a signal, revealing important information about the quality of the nest builder. So being able to build a nest that will be sexy to potential mates is important. So yeah, I think cognition plays a really important role across a range of different contexts, being able to gauge, okay, well, the conditions are going to be like this into the future. So you might need to construct a nest in a particular way to maximize the embryo survival down the track. So being able to anticipate what might happen into the future obviously would require some cognitive capabilities as well.
You are listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. We've been talking about fish nest building and reproductive behaviour with Professor Bob Wong from Monash University. And, you know, I guess because I'm a little bit bird biased, I've been comparing fish to birds a lot, and I'm going to continue to do so. So one of my favourite types of birds is the bowerbird.
and their name is derived from the male bowerbird strategy of wooing the female by constructing a decorative bower, which is basically an architectural structure made with twigs propped up into towers and archways, carefully adorned with colourful objects or spiderwebs or flowers. So I asked Bob if there was any kind of fish that display this creative flair as well.
You know, there are whole range of fish species from different families that build very elaborate structures. Some of them are actually what we would term nests, that is receptacles that would be later used for holding eggs or embryos. But some of them are like a bowerbird bower. So a bower isn't actually a nest, it's a nest-like structure. But there are species of fish that also build these kinds of nest-like structures that actually don't function as a nest per se, but the quality of the construction is something that's very important for females during mate choice. Now, returning to a species which does actually build a nest to hold eggs and developing embryos, a few years ago I was working in the Baltic Sea on a species of fish called a sand goby. And these are small, shallow water, bottom-dwelling fish with tender parental care. So the males look after the babies. The males look for little stones or shells in the environment, and then they excavate under the little stone or shell a chamber, and they pile sand on top of it to create this nest, this little chamber in the substrate. Mm-hmm. And the males will court the females and try and attract her to enter the nest and lay her eggs. Now, researchers, collaborators of ours, have previously shown that males will actually increase their parental behaviours inside the nest, so increase their fanning rate to try and attract the females, because the researchers also showed that in these species of fish, females choose males that are going to be good fathers. And so males will actually increase their parental effort at the nest to try and woo those females, you know, basically saying, oh, look at me, I'm going to be a really good dad, so you might want to mate with me.
Interesting, interesting. So you kind of describe these little burrows, these little sand goby chambers. Would you be able to talk about some of the different morphologies of a fish nest? What do fish nests look like in different contexts, and what are they built out of, and where are they built?
Tessa, the beauty and complexity of fish nests, I would argue, probably rival those in your beloved birds. So we have, in some cases, very simple structures, you know, maybe just a shallow depression on the bottom of a substrate, or maybe laying eggs on a leaf that that the parents would then, you know, tend to, right through to really elaborate structures. You know, I worked on another species of fish in Europe called a stickleback, and the males build these nests out of bits of algae, and they weave these like almost like a cocoon-like structure into the substrate, with an entrance and an exit, and that's the nesting environment that the eggs will be laid into. Mm-hmm. Another really quirky example come from fish called bitterlings, which are freshwater fish that are found in parts of Asia and Europe. And what's remarkable about bitterlings is that they actually use mussels as a living nest. So they will actually lay their eggs inside these live mussels, and the mussels would then basically serve as the nest, because as the mussel, so these mollusks, bivalve mollusks, would then serve as the nest for these bitterling fish. So you have this whole gamut of complexity, from just laying eggs on a substrate of some sort, right through to building elaborate structures specifically for eggs and developing embryo, through to even using other organisms as their nest.
So when these, was it the, no, you said bitterling, what was the fish before that you mentioned?
And sticklebacks.
The sticklebacks. So when the sticklebacks build the nest, do they, like, when they weave it, do they use their little fins, or do they, like, carry around bits of seaweed in their mouth? How do they build it?
cute to watch. The fish will use their mouths and basically build the structure. You can see them tucking the filamentous algae into the sand. And they also have a special organ which produces a type of glue called spiggin, which helps to glue the vegetation into place. So when you're observing these male sticklebacks building their nest, you'll see them carry vegetation and weaving them into the nest. And you'll also see them almost pressing their bodies, their bellies against the structure, basically excreting this glue-like structure to glue the vegetation into place. Now, there are other related species of sticklebacks where researchers from Scandinavia have shown that the males will actually even pick brightly coloured spangle objects. So I think the researchers placed some shiny threads into a fish tank and found that the sticklebacks would choose some of these bright contrasting materials to put into their nests. And I think the title of that scientific paper that came out had something like the artistic stickleback or something like that. So when we think of things like bowerbirds building these elaborate, beautiful bowers out of twigs and decorating the court of their bowers with found objects like flowers and fruit, and there is a fishy equivalent. There are fish that actually also incorporate, I guess in nature, they'll be incorporating contrasting coloured seaweeds into the nest. So it's not just about looking at using nests to look after babies. It can also be about building nests to attract mates. And, you know, going back to the earlier question about cognitive abilities, those kinds of things obviously would require high cognitive skills.
Yeah, interesting to see what beauty is in the eye of the fish and what they see as attractive. So it sounds like you've seen a lot of different kinds of fish building pretty interesting different kinds of nests all over the world. Is there any fish that is still on your list that you'd like to observe build a nest, or any fish generally that you'd like to observe that's still kind of you hope to see someday?
Yeah, look, I think any kind of parental care is just fascinating, right? The idea that animals are looking after young to increase the prospects of their survival, which ultimately then benefit the parents. When I was a kid, you know, going back to my story about seeing these kissing fishes kiss, fish belong to a group of fish that include members such as the Siamese fighting fish that people keep also as pets. They actually build bubble nests. So the males, male fighting fish and also some other species will take up air from the water's surface and then incorporate mucus into those bubbles and then blow them out. And then those bubbles will form a floating raft, sometimes under vegetation, sometimes directly just below the water's surface. And you just get this mass of little bubbles. And when they spawn, the males will collect the eggs after the embrace of the females, after she's laid the eggs, after he's released his sperm. He'll quickly go down and collect the eggs and then spit them into the bubble nest. I have seen bubble nests in aquaria. It would be super cool, right, to be able to see a wild Siamese fighting fish in a paddy field somewhere in Asia, tending to their babies, in the natural habitat. So that would definitely be on the bucket list.
I hope you get to see it. It sounds extraordinary. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And it's been so interesting to talk to you. I'm going to look at fish differently from now on.
My absolute pleasure, Tessa.
That was Dr. Bob Wong from Monash University, a true delight to have on the show. There's actually a ton of interesting research happening in Bob's lab, from studying the effects of pharmaceutical drugs on fish to deep dives into fish cognition, and you can check it out on their website, which is bobwonglab.org. You can find that link in the show notes, plus all of our previous episodes on the 3CR website. Go to 3cr.org.au/radioblue. And it looks like the tide's out for us this morning here on Out of the Blue. Stay tuned for Out of the Pan with Sally coming up next. I'll leave you with this tune, which is Fishing for Fishies by King Giz and the Liz Whiz. Until next time, stay salty, my friends.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.